This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Here it comes. As the world warms, humans will have to move back from the ocean, cities and all. Orrin H. Pilkey wrote a book on it, Retreat from a Rising Sea, Hard Choices in an Age of Climate Change. In North Carolina, he is the James B. Duke Professor Emeritus of Earth Sciences. Dr. Pilkey published over 250 works and 45 books. Duke University named a building after him, and I hope Dr. Pilkey will not mind if I called him the granddaddy of coastal science. From Durham, North Carolina, Orrin Pilkey, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
So over the past centuries, Americans did move massively from the interior to the coast, and that's where we find fabulously priced real estate and movies about seaside bliss. Are you really sure that is going away, whether we like it or not?
I think there's not the slightest doubt that it's going away, primarily because of sea level rise. A second factor is the expected intensification, a factor that works here, at least on the southeastern U.S., intensification of hurricanes. This, in the last 2 years, we've had 18 storms, hurricanes, North Atlantic hurricanes. That's not unusual, but what is unusual, we had 5 of those 18 were really big storms causing a lot of damage. And I think that's the beginning of the expected intensification of storms based on the warming of the ocean.
Yes, it's true. A single giant storm can practically rewrite the coastline.
That's for sure. The biggest disaster in those storms was Puerto Rico, where the storm, a Category 4 storm, almost Category 5, just crossed the whole island. It was really a disaster. And it killed, they have estimated, more than 2,000 people. A real disaster if ever there was one.
Didn't a storm turn you toward your lifetime work?
Yes, as a matter of fact, my parents retired in Waveland, Mississippi, right at a house that was an elevation of 13 feet. And they had Hurricane Camille in 1969 that came through. Now, Hurricane Camille was one of the biggest ever to hit the U.S., not the biggest, but the most intense. 200-mile-an-hour winds were actually recorded on land, and their house was severely damaged. The house then disappeared completely in Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Anyhow, my brother and I went down to Waveland, Mississippi, to help the parents, and I was so impressed with the power of nature at the shoreline. I hadn't even thought about it. At this time, I was more of an oceanographer going to sea. This basically turned me into a, shall we say, a shallow water person rather than a deep water person. It was so impressive. It's just hard to describe.
Apparently, millions of us humans think we can fix this, maybe with new sand dunes or floating stilt homes or some technology. Can we fix it, really?
In my opinion, there is no, we cannot fix this. We can do something. Building a seawall, which will destroy the beach, but building a seawall will sometimes offer shelter for an intermediate storm, but not a big storm. We can pump up sand on the beach, which we call beach replenishment. That does stop some damage because the storm concentrates on taking away the sand rather than taking away the hull. But basically, in a time of rising sea level, we simply cannot hold the shoreline still. Most of our efforts are to hold the shoreline still, and the shoreline wants to move back because of the sea level rise.
Did North Carolina actually pass a law against predictions of rising seas like yours?
Well, they almost said that. They didn't quite say it that way, but that's the way it kind of came out in the media, and it wasn't far from that. North Carolina in 1985 passed the first regulation prohibiting seawalls, which was a giant step forward. I was very proud of them. And because the reason they prohibited seawalls is because they eventually destroy beaches. And, of course, beaches are critical to coastal living, especially in a coast like ours, which has a lot of tourists and so forth. But they somehow changed administrations, and there was a lot of resistance to the idea that you couldn't build a seawall and so forth. So they said, they decided, instead of looking at a sea level rise of 3 feet or so, which is what most communities are looking at, they decided to look at a sea level rise of in the next 30 years, which was 8 inches. And in effect, they said, we'll ignore sea level rise. And in fact, the way it was interpreted often was they made sea level rise illegal, which in effect, they actually did. It was really irresponsible and even stupid in the context of what we know is going to what we know is happening right now.
In 2012, right after Hurricane Sandy, I spoke with Professor J. Cort Stevenson from the University of Maryland, and we talked about surge defenses in cities around the world. So let's talk about some of the great cities of the American South. Can cities there successfully retreat from the shoreline, and will they have time to do so?
Actually, each city is different. Each city is different, has a different problem. Miami has the worst problem because Miami is situated on top of a thick, 20 to 75 foot thick limestone that is extremely porous. And to give you an idea of what that means, small ponds within the city of Miami actually show tides. Maybe just an inch or even less than that, but tides that correspond with the offshore tide. This means that, in effect, Miami is really sitting in the water. They can't build seawalls to help them. They can't build levees or dikes. So I anticipate that Miami will have to be completely abandoned within this century, probably within 50 years or so. New Orleans is a different situation. New Orleans is fine until the inevitable Hurricane Camille type, a very strong hurricane, comes by and floods the city again. I anticipate that at some unknown time, New Orleans will also have to go away for sure. Wilmington, North Carolina, which is flooding quite a bit right now due to the so-called nuisance tides. These are high tides that come around as a result of, they're really the old spring tide, but they're higher now because of sea level rise. Anyhow, Wilmington is another city that's quite low. And, you know, sometimes portions of the city are quite high and are not going to be impacted by sea level rise directly. But if the surrounding area is flooded, which is often the case, the roads coming to the higher areas are flooded. And so you can't go to grocery stores, can't go to schools, churches, and so forth. So you can't just look at the amount of flooding from, let's say, a 3 foot sea level rise. You have to consider the whole big picture of what that does to transportation.
Well, I'm thinking, too, of the big projects that people around the world have invested in right by the ocean. Boston's Big Dig, the new tunnel in downtown Seattle, or the airport built out on the sea like Japan's Kansai International Airport. We're investing trillions of dollars of social wealth in these projects as though you never wrote your books and papers, as though the scientists around the world have never warned. That's a bad idea.
Yeah, it's hard to deal with the city problem, you know. But I think we can learn something from the Dutch. The Dutch, now, they're not like the United States. They're a very small country. There's no place to move to. A good part of the country is below sea level. They're building big, huge dunes along the shoreline, and which they kind of have to. Remember, they're in a different situation than we are, and they're doing things like designating parks and parking areas as to be flooded. One big park in Holland actually has tennis courts and soccer fields and swimming pools, and the whole reason that park exists it's a place to be flooded in the case of a big storm. And of course, they're also putting a big, they put a big gate across at Rotterdam, across the mouth of the estuary, a 70-foot high wall that will move back and forth. That they can do because they have to, and it's a wealthy, well-educated country. But for us, we don't have that privilege. We're going to have to, in our cities like New York, have a lot of pretty good elevation, although 40,000 people in New York City live at elevations below 3 feet, and all those and a lot of others will have to move somewhere. Boston can temporarily solve its problem by building a massive seawall in front of around the front of the city. Boston is in large part made up of very low elevation, pumped up mud from the Boston Harbor, and so it's all of downtown Boston is very very low and very vulnerable. But they can, unlike Miami, they can protect themselves for a while with a big seawall. But if the sea level rise goes up to as much as 6 feet, which is some people think it's getting up that way because of increased melting of the Antarctic ice sheet, then Boston, especially during a storm, is going to be in very serious problems. So each city is different, and some cities are more protectable, so we say, than others. There is no city that is not going to be, no coastal city that is not going to be severely impacted. And, of course, all the ports and harbors of the world are going to, all the docks are going to have to be raised. And, of course, that makes a big problem for commerce and for the military, too.
Yeah, I've talked to a couple of people about the situation of the U.S. Navy and the Coast Guard and where their bases are and how much they're already flooding, some of them. You know, we tend to pay attention when cities flood, but not when damaged coasts kind of collapse into the sea. Erosion on the coast isn't news, but should it be, Orrin Pilkey?
Oh, absolutely. We, you know, we have here in North America, we have, well, in the U.S., we have 3,000 miles of barrier islands. These are the most vulnerable major coastal environments there is. And it's a huge thing economically, of course, with all the tourist industry. In the state of Florida, in a recent study there, that looking at the population of people, of Americans who live below 3 feet in elevation, New York was number one. 49,000 people live below 3 feet in elevation. But of the 25 cities that they looked at, 20 of them were in Florida. So Florida is in really bad shape, potentially. And their governor, who has now been elected to be their senator, does not believe in global climate change. That doesn't help the situation where we should be making plans. You know, I've talked about all the evacuation that's going to happen. One problem we see is that there's nobody planning on that evacuation. Where are 4 million people? That's the number expected from Miami. Where are 4 million people going to go? As you pointed out, we've had a lot of evacuations in the past, like our Dust Bowl in the 20s, and after World War II, a massive movement of people from the south to the north. But those were individuals who just went one at a time and so forth. But now we're thinking about 4 million people who are probably going to move in a relatively short period of time. We better do some planning.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from North Carolina. My guest is the well-known expert on how shorelines work, Dr. Orrin H. Pilkey. We're talking about the inevitable march of the sea into the land that we thought was ours as the world warms. Well, you raised a really great point there, because when we talk about rising seas, too many Americans think it will strike islands in the South Pacific or Bangladesh. But there was a recent study in Nature Climate Change. It was published in March 2016, titled Millions Projected to Be at Risk from Sea Level Rise in the Continental United States. And they project that, as you say, with more intense storms and the rising seas, we will see a movement of people not seen in the United States since the Great Migration from the South during the last century. This is going to be startling news for the next generation or two, I think.
Boy, oh boy. I often think about my grandchildren and what they're going to be facing and what their children are going to be facing. It's really going to be a major shakeup of this country, for sure, and all over the world as well. The three places which are going to be flooded most intensely and will produce the most refugees, one is South Florida, particularly Miami. Two, in Miami and Fort Lauderdale and Miami Beach and so forth, Daytona Beach. Then the second one is the Mississippi Delta, where there are about 2 million people who are expected to be fairly quickly displaced by sea level rise, meaning probably within this century or maybe just a little past the end of this century that they will have to get out of there. And the third large area that's going to be flooded but doesn't have too much population is what we call the Inner Banks, which is a large, flat, swampy area behind the Outer Banks of North Carolina and partly in Virginia. There are probably less than 1 million people, but that whole area will be flooded.
And we're also talking about coastlines in, well, the city of Sydney and Shanghai and parts of Vancouver will be lost. And it's a long shopping list around the world. This is going to be a global change for the coming generations, I think.
It most certainly is. It most certainly is a global problem. In our book, we concentrated primarily on the U.S., but boy, some of the stories coming out of Bangladesh, for example, you know, when they get a big hurricane, the numbers of people who are missing or killed are 100,000 or so. And what they have done, by the way, is pretty interesting, because people can't really escape. The road system isn't good enough. Not everybody doesn't have a car and so forth and so on. So they have built a series of shelters, very substantially built shelters that can withstand winds and are high enough off the ground with stilts and so forth that they will not be impacted by a hurricane. And so people can rush to their nearest shelter and crowd in there while the storm is going on. It's something that could be used here, too. We have a real problem with people escaping from our cities in Charleston, South Carolina, and in the Mississippi Delta. Here we've had storms come by in which people tried to get away, like in Katrina, tried to get away, and they ended up being jammed on the highway. And in the case of Charleston, they have a 4-lane interstate coming into the city, but they kept two of those lanes open for, quote, emergency vehicles. So everybody in Charleston who wanted to escape had to go out the two lanes. And it seems so strange to see these photographs of the two lanes which are jammed because of accidents and so forth. People ran out of gas. And on the other two lanes, there's nobody, not a thing going on. And that we've got to do some more planning, some better planning on evacuation. And I think we learned some lessons from the fires in California recently, where they had pretty good plans for that city of paradise and of escape route, but then three of the four escape routes were covered by smoke and were impassable. It's a different situation, of course, but it's the same kind of problem. To get people away during emergencies needs some more planning. We really need to work on that.
So facing an unstoppable ocean over time, can you expand further on what you mean by walk away methodically? What should happen? What could happen?
What I'm saying is we should be retreating now. We should not wait until the wolf is at the door. We should be moving now. For example, every time a storm occurs on any shoreline anywhere, we should not replace that building. Buildings that are damaged should not be replaced. That's one possible way to begin retreating. And others, we're just going to have to start moving back, and we can do it in a planned fashion, I think. It will be expensive and it will be painful. But if we don't do that, then in 30, 40, 50 years, we will move back, whether we like it or not, but we'll move back in what I call tactical disarray. It'll be even more costly, and it'll be a mess. Everybody's moving right now quickly, so let's do it now.
We've got to change our whole idea of insurance, too. The private industry bailed on insuring a lot of coastal properties. I thought that might discourage people, but no, the states' governments rushed in with their own insurance, backed by all of us taxpayers. At some point, we've got to give up on insuring people and paying them to rebuild just where they were already wiped out by the sea.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. Yes, that's exactly the point. And the insurance, we have federal flood insurance, among other types of insurance, and that is, I think, $12 billion in the red. We should raise insurance premiums to the point that they will pay for the risk. As it is, the public pays for the risk because the insurance is not sufficient. The premiums are not sufficient to pay for the damage. If that happens, the cost of living near the shore would raise instantly, very quickly, and it would discourage a lot of development. Discourage of nearshore development is a good thing.
From a scientist's perspective, does it matter whether the President of the United States believes in rising seas?
Yeah, that's the most difficult question. I guess it's not difficult. In fact, it matters a lot. The thing is most distressing of all is not only does he not believe in global climate change, but we are actively working against global climate change. We're actually taking moves that will favor increased rates of climate change, such as putting tariffs on solar panels, changing the mileage requirements on cars, and so forth and so on. So many ways that we are actually making the problem worse. So it does make a big difference. And I think we have been in the past, at least, a leader. We've taken international leadership here and trying to fight, make moves against global climate change. But, boy, that has gone away completely now.
In 2016, I interviewed the world's greatest coral expert, Australia's Charlie Varan. And it was heartbreaking. He explored and he documented the coral world that he loved, and now he's charting its demise. As one of the great educators about the coast, I think you were in the same position. True?
Well, yes. Yes, I did. I have been there from the beginning, so to speak, because I'm an old man now. I can remember, and then I can remember when 30, 40 years ago when it was radical to say things like we can't build seawalls if you're going to destroy the beaches and we've got to plan retreat. I am so pleased that that is no longer a radical thought, but there was a long time there where it was so discouraging and I took a lot of heat, to put it mildly. In one small town in South Carolina, the city council passed a resolution saying that I was no longer welcome to come there. But at any rate, that's part of the game, and I kind of recognize that in a way that attitude was a sign that I was actually having some impact.
Well, the sea will pass a motion saying that the people in that little town will no longer be welcome there as the tides keep coming in, I suppose. Now, Oren, I know you have talented children. They have co-authored and even illustrated some of your books. But now, as you and I start to get kind of oldish, what can we tell our grandchildren, or should we tell them at all?
Oh, I think we should tell them. I think we would want our grandchildren to be really aware of the situation. And every individual has opportunities to make the point, in your breakfast table conversation about, if we're going to get a car, Dad, why don't we get a car with low mileage? We don't want any of those big cars, et cetera, and so forth. I mean, I think everybody needs to be educated. And my grandchildren or our grandchildren will certainly vote someday, too. In fact, one of mine is already voting. And he, it, I think, is voting in the right way as far by my definition. But I think education is so important. And look, we wouldn't have a president like the type that we have if he had been educated in his younger days, if he was aware. People need to understand about science. We need to understand how science works. You know, science works by criticism, and often statements made about climate change by one person or another are criticized, like somebody recently, I think it was Jim Hansen, the guy who informed the Congress in 1988 that the sea level was rising. Well, he says the sea level could rise as much as 10 feet by 2100. Well, he's gotten a lot of criticism for that, but that's okay. Don't throw out his opinion just because it's criticized. Remember, that's an opinion. That's one endpoint. Maybe it will. Probably it won't, but what I have found, besides learning facts about global climate change, it's also important to understand science and scientists and how we work.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you like this. This is a marvelous opportunity for me, and I hope that those of you, I hope that people living near the coast now will think about taking moves now, be planning now for movement, for moving your house. And if you're going down to near the coast, if you want to build, you want a house that's near the sea, you got to remember, if you can see the sea can see you, and act accordingly. And make your choices in the context of the science of global climate change that is going to impact in so many ways on all of us.
We have been talking with Duke University Professor Emeritus Orrin Pilkey. From his vast record of publishing on The Way the Coastline Works, I'm working with his book, Retreat from a Rising Sea, Hard Choices in an Age of Climate Change. You can find links to all of this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Orrin, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure, for sure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.